A lot of talk about the weather today here in mid-Michigan. We'll really be loosening up the landscape. High temperatures of 45 to 50 or so. And on the heels of this winter, 45 might as well be 70, right? 45 is the new 70. Later this hour on Current State, more warming, the less desirable kind, I'm afraid. Amy Balkin is the curator of a collection of objects from around the world, from places that could disappear because of climate change. Islands, for example, that might vanish because of higher ocean levels, etc. A people's archive of sinking and melting. Later this hour on Current State. Also, WKAR's Peter Worf and Mark Switzgable preview this summer's live classical music calendar in just a few minutes. At the top of our show, changes may be in store for special education students and teachers here in Michigan. Lately, the Michigan Department of Education has been getting public comment on a host of proposed rules changes that govern special education. They include giving local school districts more authority over special education staffing, also how Michigan evaluates special education students, and then how they customize students' individual education plans, labeled IEPs. Now, two public meetings on the rules changes, one in Detroit, one here in Lansing, are scheduled for this afternoon. The period to comment via email ends this Thursday. Current State offers several perspectives on the proposed changes today. First, we turn to Vanessa Kiesler. Vanessa is a deputy superintendent for the Michigan Department of Education, which is proposing the rules changes. Welcome, Vanessa.
Thank you, Mark.
A little context first here. How often does the Department of Education propose a series of changes like this? Is this an annual thing or less often?
These are not annual changes. It's a periodic updating and review of our Michigan administrative rules for special education to determine alignment with the federal IDEA laws. So this is, I believe we did the last rules update maybe 5 or 6 years ago. So it's not every year, but periodically so we can ensure alignment with the federal regulations.
Okay. Now, there are altogether about 8 or 10 proposed rule changes. In layperson's terms, Vanessa, which 2 or 3 of them would you say are most impactful?
The goal with all these rules, Mark, is to ensure that Michigan students and Michigan students with disabilities in particular have the highest quality education and service that they can, and that we provide that as easily as possible. I think the couple rules that are most impactful, you mentioned that there was some changes to staffing. We have enhanced the rules to require that ISDs and local districts review their staffing to make sure they have the right kind of expertise in their staff to meet the needs of their students with disabilities in their district. So if there's been a number of more students with autism diagnoses, for example, do you have appropriate staffing to meet the autism needs of students in your district? I think the other key change, one of the other key changes, is we are looking at how you do the whole process of evaluation of need of the students and getting to that individualized education program, trying to streamline that process, make sure that parents are involved throughout the whole process in many ways, and that students get those special, unique services. That's what makes special education special, is you have a unique plan for every student.
Let's zero in a little bit more closely on these individualized education plans, the IEPs, and this evaluation process. Could you walk us briefly through the process as it currently plays out, involving parents and their children, when they go from suspecting their child might need extra help to actually getting an IEP?
Mm-hmm. So there's a process to gather input, evaluate the needs of the child, and then actually write the plan. And these rules changes try to bring that process more into alignment and make it quicker. So the proposed changes would have a team of individuals. There's rules about who has to be on that team. It always includes the parent, who would meet and evaluate what the child's needs are. And then based on that, that would eventually lead to, if the parent consents, that would lead to an IEP team developing the actual IEP.
And how does that differ from what's happening now?
Right now, it's more of a it doesn't change. We're not proposing any changes to the fact that we need a team to evaluate the needs of the child and then get to the IEP. It brings the process. It removes a step from the process. You don't have to have necessarily two teams meet to do this. It makes it more efficient to get the services to the students.
Now, some of your critics here, some of the critics of the changes, I won't say your critics, but critics of the changes, are also concerned about that they maintain that aligning state standards with federal standards is really code for cuts, since they maintain state standards exceed federal standards currently. Is that true? Do Michigan special education rules currently offer safeguards that the federal standards don't?
In general, no. Alignment doesn't mean lowering standards for Michigan. There are a few places in the rules where our requirements were different than the federal requirements, and so we wanted to bring those into alignment. But sometimes the federal requirements also increase or change. And so it's alignment is really just making sure that Michigan is following the federal IDEA law, as well as what the Michigan special education community needs for Michigan students.
Let's return to the staffing issue here briefly as well. Critics are concerned that over the increasing authority districts apparently will have to reduce special education staffing. You talked about an increase scenario, but they seem to be more concerned about the opposite trend. First of all, do you expect the rule change will result in reduced staffing as well?
No, and actually the special education caseloads, the requirements for those are set out elsewhere in law. So this change is to require that they review their staffing to possibly increase or to tailor their staffing. Again, if you are staffed to provide special education services to a certain population of special education students and that population changes, then you won't be well equipped to meet the individual needs of those students.
Are you saying the caseloads guidelines are in the federal law or in the IDEA law?
They are specified in Michigan law elsewhere.
In Michigan law. Now, to what extent, Vanessa, are these rules changes triggered by budget pressures in districts?
These rules changes are not in response to budget pressures. We spent 18 months in the field talking with parents, talking with special education community, talking with administrators of special education and ISDs and locals, and looking at what's in the federal criteria and also looking at what's in our rules and saying what could be better, what could be different. It really is an iterative process meant to enhance service provision to students with disabilities. And actually, that's why we're in the public comment period right now. This is a critically important part of the process where we ask the public to reflect and provide feedback so that we can make any modifications before these become actual administrative rule.
Can you see how advocates, though, might see a red flag with regard to the staffing issue, for example, if a staff of special education teachers could go down, I think they're inclined to link that with budget pressure. You're saying that is a misunderstanding of the proposed rules changes?
Yes, it is not meant to say reduce your staffing or let's increase caseloads to balance the budget. The point is to say you need to have the appropriate staff levels for the needs of students with disabilities in your district, and you need to review that annually so that you do have those right resources for those students.
And how would you generally describe the response of special education teachers and administrators so far to the proposed rules changes? You have been taking emails. You have been taking conventional mail. Mm-hmm. What's the response been?
In terms of the official public comment, we are really excited about the great response we've had to public comment. We've had just a phenomenal response. We used a new system this year because we wanted more feedback from the public, and we've actually, to date, we have over 1,000 responses through that system, as well as a small number through email and regular mail. We will review all the public comment when it's in. In general, right now, it seems like people are engaging with the rules and interested in them and mostly positive. But, you know, again, we need to review the comment very individually, all 1,000 of them or more. But in the past 18 months, working with the field and doing this outside of the official public comment period, in general, the special education community that we've been working with is supportive of the changes. We have some very good, and this is where public comment is great, we have some very good specifics from, for instance, I know the Michigan Protection Advocacy Service agencies on next. They have some very specific feedback, which we appreciate it when our stakeholders engage with us on that. But overall, people are supportive of the changes. We look forward to reviewing public comment to make final determinations.
We want to thank you for joining us here today. Vanessa Kiesler is a deputy superintendent for the Michigan Department of Education, which is proposing a series of 8 to 10 rules changes as to how special education is administered here in Michigan. Vanessa, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to a couple of other guests for their perspectives on the rules changes. Mark McWilliams is an attorney for the Michigan Protection and Advocacy Service, MPAS. MPAS is a nonprofit organization designated by the governor to advocate and protect the legal rights of people with disabilities in Michigan. Welcome, Mark.
Good morning, Mark. I'm glad to be here.
Some of your concern stems from proposed changes to these procedures. Let's zero in on the evaluations here, first of all. Each of these procedures involves every Michigan special education student. Number one, the time taken to evaluate each student's proficiency. And then second, the IEP, the Individualized Education Plan that's designed for that student. Why are you concerned about that process?
Well, rules have three purposes. One is they are law. That means that they have the effect of law, just as if the legislature had passed them. They set the agenda for enforcement. That is, when the state or the federal government decides to enforce the rules, that is what they enforce is what's written in the rules. And the third is they create a public perception. There are hundreds of school districts in Michigan. There are thousands of professionals that are working hard to serve students with disabilities in Michigan. And the word on the street is often just as important as what the rules actually say and how the Department of Education can interpret them. So turning to the evaluation process, the current process takes about 62 school days from the time a parent makes a written request for an evaluation to when services actually begin. And there are a lot of ifs in there. That is, if a team meets and decides that a child has a disability, they then do an evaluation, they create an individualized education program. Right now, it's about 62 school days. By our calculation in the proposed rules, it's split differently now, but the total number of days we think is reduced, but that to 50 school days. But that assumes a number of things. It assumes that services will begin immediately when an IEP team decides that the IEP is ready to go. That's not explicit in the rules. We think that it's implied by federal law, but so there are a lot of ifs. I mean, I think that what that means to me is, and what it means my concern is that, yes, if the rules are read a certain way, you can have a better outcome for students in that they get services sooner. But if they're not read that way, and if there's a possible way you can read them different ways, the outcomes might not be as good.
Let's bring in another guest right now. Marcy Lipset is a longtime grassroots advocate for persons with disabilities and is the founder and co-chair of the Michigan Alliance for Special Education. She is advocating against the rules changes. Welcome, Marcy.
Good morning.
Let's zero in on the evaluation and IEP piece of these proposed rules changes. I mean, the MDE maintains that this will shorten the timeline and actually improve results, better evaluations, and better plans. What's your response to that claim?
My response, there are two parts to that response. The first response is I do not believe the evaluations will be better with the removal of the multidisciplinary evaluation team. It will reduce the individuals and experts involved in evaluating. The second part of this is that if they were simply proposing, as they are, to restrict the evaluation timeline to 30 school days and not give school districts the opportunity to extend those, which is what they can currently do, I would be perfectly supportive of it. However, they're proposing to remove the actual individualized educational program team meeting from the new school day timeline. And that, I believe, is going to, frankly, be very dangerous, very misunderstood, and wreak havoc. 57 ISD sent a flyer out last Thursday trying to explain the rules, and in their flyer, it states that they do not know how this is going to work at the local level. Personally, I'm a parent and an advocate. I believe this will remove parents from the evaluation eligibility process, and especially the process of crafting the IEP, which is this legally binding document with all of these rules that guides and governs how a child receives meaningful educational benefit and a free appropriate public education.
Mark McWilliams, how much of Marcy Lipset's concerns do you share?
I share the concerns that these rules can be interpreted differently. I do believe that there is certainly federal law that requires that IEP teams include certain people, that there are protections under federal law for the process to occur with the participation of parents. But one of the three things that rules do is they create a public perception, and the perception can be important.
But what is the reality here as far as you are concerned, Mark? Do you feel that this multidisciplinary team approach is going to be seriously weakened if these proposed changes go through?
The term multidisciplinary evaluation team is no longer in the rules. If that's interpreted to say we don't need a team anymore, that would be a problem. The members of the teams are still specified in the law. And so, although the phrase multidisciplinary team disappears, each time there is an evaluation, there has to be an evaluation by someone.
Marcy, let's move on to some of your other concerns. I mean, on your website, you go so far as to say that together these changes would be catastrophic. Tell us more, please.
Oh, I absolutely believe they're catastrophic. The Michigan Department of Ed has continued to sell these revisions as technical changes to align with federal law. And most people don't realize the nuance of align. When you say you are aligning with a federal law, any federal law, you are reducing your state rules because your state-imposed rules exceed the minimum required in federal law. So these changes are not technical. They are substantive. And there are new rules added. So, for example, there's a new rule added that would expand the authority of our intermediate school districts and our local school districts to review and to determine special education staffing annually. And the department has asserted that I'm misunderstanding that, and I would challenge that by the nature of the definition of determine, this will allow ISDs and school districts to not only determine, but to expand and increase the number of children on special education teacher caseloads. We already have a problem going back to 2002 with the ISD authority under the rule that is being proposed for further revision. In 2002, a new rule passed allowing ISDs, the intermediate school districts, to override and to create their own special education programs and services. And not one ISD has used this opportunity since 2002 to reduce the number of children in a special education program or to create capacity for children that we already underserve. This rule has been used for budgetary purposes. It has been used absolutely to balance the budget on the backs of the kids and, frankly, their teachers. So from my perspective, reading the rules, the combination of allowing ISDs to override the special ed programs and services, coupled with this new proposed rule that will allow the ISDs and districts to review and determine staffing annually, is catastrophic. It will basically give many children no reason to attend school.
it just won't be meaningful.
Mark McWilliams, Vanessa Kiesler of the Department of Education, what I heard her say was essentially downplay the impact of alignment with federal standards. Where do you stand on that? Is aligning with federal standards compromising our current system?
Michigan has its own special education law. The current law complies with federal law. That is, it's consistent. So,
but does it exceed the federal law?
It does.
Okay.
Yes, it does. It does.
So alignment, is alignment to your way of thinking compromising the current system?
It reduces protections.
Okay. Marcy, to what extent are rules changes triggered by budget pressures in districts? Do you feel that is a motivation for some of these proposed rules changes?
I believe it's twofold again. I believe budgets are part of it, but frankly, Governor Snyder, he promised that he was going to go department by department and eliminate any state rule that exceeds any federal law. And from conversations with some MDE supervisors last fall, he had the department tied up for weeks looking at these rules. So I simply tell people, if you love him or you hate him, he's keeping his promise. He is working to reduce the state rules. And that simply, and then ultimately, that does reduce your appropriation, because under Michigan's Headley Amendment, any state-imposed rule has to be funded by the state. So as you erode your state-imposed rules that exceed, you are reducing the amount of money that has to be appropriated. And that's always been a bone of contention for school districts, rightly so, that they have not received enough money for special education. At the state level, their bone has always been that the federal government has not met its obligation to fund 40% of special education and only funds about 17%. So the funding has always been a problem, but there really are other ways to look at the budget crisis in school districts in Michigan. There are answers to some of this.
Mark, is there a way, briefly, we're just about out of time, is there a way to fairly streamline special education operations in Michigan?
Well, I think we can streamline more than special education. I think we could centralize purchasing in this state for everything that is purchased to run our schools instead of some of these consortiums. I think we could do it statewide.
Let's get Mark McWilliams' take on that one, too.
Yes, students with disabilities are students first. You start by making sure that they are included into general education settings and see how they can get the supports they need.
All right. We want to say thanks to both of our guests, Mark McWilliams of MPAS and Marcy Lipset, who is with the Michigan Alliance for Special Education, MPAS, the Michigan Protection and Advocacy Service. Once again, two public sessions today, opinion gathering sessions today involving proposed rules changes to special education here in the state of Michigan, one of them here in Lansing, the other in Detroit. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Well, we're all dreaming of warmer days to come, and maybe some of you have started making plans for summer already. It's pretty irresistible impulse here after the winter we've had. There's already a lot of plans underway for music festivals here in Michigan here for this summer, and WKAR's Peter Worf is here to tell us a little bit more. We got a nice calendar of events to look at, Peter.
We do, Mark. Hey, what did you say at the top of the show about whether 45 is the new
45
70?
Is the new right. 70.
Almost warm enough to think about grabbing that lawn chair and hearing some outdoor music,
Doesn't
maybe?
That sound great?
Yeah, it does. Maybe here around the Lansing area, it's a Dado Riverfront Park, maybe Lake Lansing out at the band shell sitting on the lawn. As you said, Mark, elsewhere, there's a lot of great music happening this summer all around Michigan, some outdoors, some indoors. Mark Schwitzgable and I talked about summer music festivals, and we started our conversation out west.
Well, the Grand Rapids Symphony has their 20th annual Picnic Pops series beginning in July. It's a series of four concerts that will be held on Thursday and Friday evenings. And the first concert is going to be called Classical Fireworks. That is going to be a fireworks concert for sure, with works like The Stars and Stripes Forever. The Cowboys Overture by John Williams, and it'll wrap up with the 1812 Overture by Tchaikovsky, as we round up the usual suspects for a fireworks concert. Yeah. And following that, there is going to be a most spectacular fireworks show of the summer, according to the information here. So that sounds like a great concert. Again, that's Thursday, July 10th, and Friday, July 11th. Those performances both at 8 o'clock. All these concerts taking place at the Canonsburg Ski Area near Grand Rapids.
Mark, I know there are several more concerts on that series. Let me touch quickly on what's happening in mid-Michigan. It's the Great Lakes Chamber Music Festival, which begins Saturday, June 14th, and goes for a couple of weeks. It starts off at the Seligman Performing Arts Center at Detroit Country Day School. The theme this year is In the Shadow of Bach, Johann Sebastian Bach and his influence throughout the centuries. So we'll hear a lot of Bach, of course, and many of the influences, as the name suggests. We'll begin with Bach and the Busoni arrangement, Fantasia Contrapuntistica. It's a mind-bending piece that is a collection of Bach works that are sort of reimagined by the great turn of the 20th century pianist Federico Busoni. Antoine Nell and James Tocco performing, and it's a 3B performance with Bach, Brahms, and Beethoven in that first concert. Some other venues, St. Hugo of the Hills in Bloomfield Hills, the Capitol Theater and Arts Center in Windsor, Temple Bethel in Bloomfield Hills, and many others. Some really creative programming going on here. On June 21st at the Seligman, Johann Sebastian Bach, Villa-Lobos Bachianas Brasileiras, so that sort of South American take on Bach notions, and then PDQ Bach, a.k.a. Peter Schickele. You know, that wonderful sort of tongue-in-cheek, rapscallion sort of Bach satire from the mind of Peter Schickele and the alter ego that he creates with PDQ Bach. June 27th, Kirk in the Hills, right near Cranbrook in Bloomfield Hills, has a really interesting program with Bach's 51st cantata, and then music from Dvorak, Shostakovich, and a piece by Gregory Wanamaker called Speed Metal Organ Blues. Yeah, it's, well, you just have to hear it to believe it. Then also in mid-Michigan, as I said, a little closer to home, performances at St. Patrick's Church in Brighton and the Carytown Concert House in Ann Arbor on June 27th and 29th. Closing night officially is June 28th at the Seligman Arts Center with Bach's Brandenburg Concertos 3, 4, and 5. Mark, take us quickly down the remainder of Picnic Pops and
near Grand Rapids.
Yeah, the series will resume on July 17th and 18th, Thursday and Friday, with 7:30 performances. Again, all these taking place at the Cannonsburg Ski Area. And if you're going to do a Pops concert, this year is perfect because it's the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' visit to the United States. And this concert is a tribute to the Beatles, featuring Classical Mystery Tour, which is one of the premier Beatles tribute bands. They'll be joining the symphony for this 50th anniversary of the British invasion. All the classic hits will be covered in that one. The following week, July 24th and the 25th, Summertime Hits. This will be featuring Veterans Pops arranger and conductor Matt Cuttingub, and he's going to be performing lots of familiar summer pieces like Summer Breeze, Saturday in the Park, The Boys of Summer, and California Girls, a little Beach Boys going on there.
Nice.
And finishing up the season with the Music of the Eagles on July 31st and August 1st as conductor-arranger Brent Habens and his full rock band return to pay tribute to a classic group. All the familiar Eagles hits will be covered there, including Desperado, Life in the Fast Lane, and Witchy Woman, and a lot more. So lots of great pop music coming up with the Grand Rapids Symphony and Friends this July here in mid-Michigan. Again, all those concerts at the Cannonsburg Ski Area.
So, Mark, we have a good deal of southeastern Michigan, mid-Michigan, and western Michigan covered. Let's go up north now. Of course, we'll be taking you to Interlaken. And before really the start of the summer season, I want to point out a wonderful concert coming up at the Interlaken Arts Academy on May 5th. Again, Bach is the theme, and Jennifer Coe is the violinist. She takes a series around her various performances across the country and around the world. It's entitled Bach and Beyond, where she explores Bach and the many composers influenced by Bach and sort of playing off of Bach. She'll be playing that concert with two of the solo violin sonatas and works by Luciano Berio and John Zorn. Again, talk about sort of mind-bending and really stretching the envelope. That's Jennifer Coe at Interlaken on May 9th. And then another violinist you may be familiar with, Joshua Bell.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, comes to play with the World Youth Symphony Orchestra. That's right in the middle of the summer season, July 13th, Joshua Bell at Interlaken with the World Youth Symphony Orchestra. And that's a look at the summer music season coming up across Michigan, including the Great Lakes Chamber Music Festival, Picnic Pops, and the Interlaken Arts Academy. Mark, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thanks, Peter.
For Mark Schwitzgable, I'm Peter Wharf for Current State.
Dr. Temple Grandin will be at Michigan State University tomorrow. She's noted for her research and writings on animal behavior, especially how to reduce stress on animals going to slaughter. Temple Grandin's also autistic and has gained visibility as an advocate who helps advance understanding of people on the autism spectrum. Current State's Melissa Benmark spoke to Temple Grandin by phone to ask what she had in mind for her talk here at MSU.
Well, I'm going to be, one of the first things I'm going to be talking about is just the basic principles of animal handling. It's really important that people that are working with cattle and pigs and other animals understand, you know, basic behavior principles. You know, there's a common assumption that big corporates bad and small places are good. You know, that's just simply not true. What I have found is badly managed is bad, and you can have badly managed either in big or small. It basically, the most of it gets down to having good management, you know, when it comes to animal handling. I'm also going to discuss some other animal welfare issues involved housing or just pushing the animal's biology too hard. We've got a dairy cow right now that has a difficult time breeding back. We've selected so much for milk production that she has difficulty having a calf every year. And in order to milk, she has to have a calf.
The foodie movement is kind of focused on the sustainable raising of animals for food, but there seems like there might be a lot of newcomers getting into the small-scale slaughter business. I mean, does that concern you? Are you worried about some of the smaller animal operations observing good practices for humane slaughter?
I think we need more small slaughter plants. You see, I think basically agriculture is going to have two major sectors. You're going to have large-scale commercial, and then you're going to have the smaller niche markets. And it's a huge need for a decent, smaller slaughter plants. And yes, they can be run really well. one of the things is people have to have be trained in things like proper stunning methods, for example, because some of the problems I've seen in small plants have simply been due to lack of knowledge. And there's people out there, consultants out there, like my friend Erica Vogue, that have been going out and helping smaller plants learn, you know, some of these good practices.
You've been noted for your work in improving the conditions for food animals that are going to slaughter. Is there another group of animals that you look at these days and think, you know, here's another situation where the welfare of these animals isn't the greatest and we're overlooking some basic things in caring for them?
I'm getting very concerned about what I call biological system overload. I was reviewing some scientific papers just a week ago on problems of osteoporosis in the laying hen. This animal has been pushed so hard to lay eggs that when they get to the end of lay, they have anywhere from 20% to 80% of the animals have broken bones because they've got osteoporosis. That's an example strictly of biological system overload. No matter what kind of good housing you put them in, they still have this problem that either goes from atrocious to bad. You know, just 20% is still really bad.
So it's almost like we're using up the animals before the end of their lives.
That's right. You're just using up the animal's body totally. And I knew there was osteoporosis problems in the laying hen, but I didn't realize how serious they were until I was just reviewing them for a paper I'm doing on animal welfare. And I just reviewed some of this laying hen stuff, you know, just a few weeks ago, and I was just horrified.
You're very good at understanding how animals process information, but do you ever find that certain animals are trickier than others for you to read and kind of get inside their heads?
Well, we've got some dogs now where they've bred out the warning, that the growling and the hackle, that the dog's going to attack. And I just had the wife of a good friend of mine got pulled down by a pit bull cross that had been rescued, and he gave no warning and pulled this poor lady down when they were out going for a walk in the park. This dog, they deliberately had bred out the danger signs, you know, where the dogs normally warn you before they bite.
So it sounds like there's some concerns not only with the way animals are being handled, but the way they're being bred.
Well, yeah, I'm concerned about dogs. I mean, when I was a child, all the dogs ran loose. We had no behavior problems. Well, on the other hand, nobody was deliberately breeding dogs to have really, truly vicious traits. That was not happening when I was a child. Then all the dogs were out there getting socialized, because sometimes in animals that are reared by themselves, if they grow to adulthood totally away from other animals, they'll often be vicious fighters, because they haven't learned to give and take of social relations. And I've seen that happen in dogs, cattle, and horses.
I know you're very busy looking just at your webpage and such with your professorship at Colorado State, books, appearances, the TED Talk. Is there some new project besides all that that you see in the near future?
Well, one of my students just finished up a really nice project looking at handling practices at feed yards in Colorado, Kansas, and Nebraska. We ended up getting really good results where some of the feed yards have really improved their handling. And I've got a paper, a little article right now in Beef Magazine. And if you're interested in some of my work on animal behavior, I've got books like Animals in Translation, Animals Make Us Human, where I talk about some of my work.
What animals do you have yourself?
Well, I can't have any. I'm traveling 90% of the time right now.
Another thing that you're noted for is helping people understand autism and some of the communications differences. And I'm wondering what's on the horizon with that for you, with that work helping
people
understand.
Well, I've been doing a lot of talks on that. And I mean, autism is a big spectrum where you're going from Einstein, who had no speech until age 3 at one end of the spectrum, to somebody that's got a lot more severe handicaps. And services today are a lot better for the more severe kids with autism. But some of the kids that we used to just call the geeks and the nerds, I'm getting worrying right now that a lot of these kids aren't learning enough working skills. I mean, one of the big things I'm pushing on is develop the kid's strengths. It could be in mathematics. It could be in art. And so they can be employable. We have a huge shortage right now in skilled trades, and that'd be an excellent excellent job for some individuals that are kind of the mildly autistic, kind of geeky, nerdy type. And we just have too much emphasis on deficits and not enough emphasis on building up the things they could be good at.
Well, and that's one of the things I think about your TED Talk that I found so inspiring, is that you were really focusing on, hey, this is not just about what people can't do. It's about what they can do.
Well, my ability in art was always encouraged, and my ability in art became the basis of my design work. Also, my ability to think in pictures helped me understand animals, because animals don't think in words. They think in sensory. They think in pictures. They think in sounds. They think in touch sensations, smell sensations. It's all kinds of little detailed sensory information.
When people talk about you, you know, just the general introduction, they talk about you being an advocate for animals and for people with autism. But I wonder if you find that another group of people is really gravitating toward you, which is for really a lot of us who have felt like we didn't belong. You know, you say the geeky and nerdy people. I mean, what is it like being a role model for people who, you know, in school just nobody got you, and then you get to this stage where you're seeing success and people seek you out?
Well, and I want to see these other kids that are kind of geeky and nerdy be successful, because I go out in the cattle industry and find a geeky, nerdy old hippie down in the maintenance shop. Well, that probably was a kid that was, you know, having a lot of problems in school. And then I'm seeing the young version of that same guy today. He's getting addicted to video games and going nowhere. And one problem I see is they're not learning work skills. I also think that taking all the hands-on classes out of the schools is the worst thing they ever did. You know, no music, art, woodworking, sewing, cooking, auto shop. And we actually have a shortage of people for doing jobs such as auto mechanic. And for some of these kids that are kind of different, that's the perfect job. It doesn't work for every one of them, but it does work for some of them. And we've also got to start learning working skills while the kids are still in high school. I'm seeing too many kids, maybe get a degree in something like philosophy, and they don't have any work skills.
One of the things, too, I think that it seems like that lack of hands-on ends up meaning for people is that anybody who doesn't sort of think along the traditional academic path doesn't have that much open to them.
Well, yeah, but there's lots of stuff out there. We need people to fix cars, and we also need people to fix all the electric wires and all of those sorts of things. I mean, like electricity, you know, that's somebody that took a year of maybe a community college course to learn that skilled trade. And I read an article about the utility companies, and they're concerned that their 50-year-olds can't climb up the poles anymore. And we need people in those jobs. They're good jobs with full benefits, and it's important work. I mean, I think people like to have electricity. They like to have their cars fixed or have their heating and air conditioning fixed or do metal fabrication. I know a metal fabricator that I'm pretty sure is on the spectrum, and he has a big shop, and he builds specialty equipment for the meat industry.
It's interesting how you refer to on the spectrum. Do you find that you can kind of almost tell just because...
Oh, I can tell. I can spot them a mile away. See, the problem we got with the autism spectrum, now that they've changed the diagnostic guideline, it's turned into this huge, gigantic spectrum, basically going from socially awkward geeks and nerds in Silicon Valley to people that are nonverbal with epilepsy and very, very severe handicaps. But what worries me is the kids that I'm going to call just so socially awkward geeks and nerds sometimes get put in a class with the much more severe kids, and they're just going nowhere, and I'm seeing way too many of them get addicted to video games. There are a few of them that can learn the programming skills to go into that industry, but that's not where most of them are going. And there's a project now called Project Search, where they have internships the last year of high school, and they're putting people into very responsible jobs, such as setting up all the surgical instruments before heart operations. And that's something where you have to be very meticulous, do it absolutely right. People on the autism spectrum are very meticulous, and they're doing a great job at this. You know, we got to be doing more, you know, creative stuff like this.
Well, Dr. Temple Grandin, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Well, it was great to be there.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Many scientists predict that as climate change becomes more extreme, dry and coastal regions around the globe will be heavily impacted by drought and rising sea levels. Entire communities could disappear. The ART Project, a people's archive of sinking and melting, documents these threatened areas. The collection is made up of objects submitted by people from around the world. The items represent places that may vanish because of the impacts of climate change. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with artist and archive curator Amy Balkin. Balkin started by explaining how the project works.
A People's Archive of Thinking and Melting is a project that I initiated a couple of years ago. And what I'm calling it is an archive of the future anterior, or what will have been. And what I'm asking people to do is, if they think that they live in a place which may disappear, become uninhabitable, to send me something from that place, because in the future that place will no longer exist to support it or them. So what I'm asking people to do is send me these contributions to collect these remnants of places that may disappear, but also the politics that go alongside the disappearance.
So when you say places that may disappear, I mean, what is the cause of this disappearance, or what's your understanding of why these places will disappear?
They'll disappear because of the geographic, political, economic implications of climate change. And what do those look like? Those look like sea level rise without fortification. They look like desertification. They look like the disappearance of water sources from places that have long had those. So there are different reasons that places may disappear. There are different sort of levels of disappearance, and there are different implications of disappearance. But those are really up to the participant to decide.
Where are some of the places that you've received items from so far?
So since last year, the archive contains contributions from Australia, Cape Verde, Santiago de Cuba, Germany, Greenland, Venice, Italy, Kivalina, Alaska, Mexico, Nepal, New Orleans, the Upper Ninth Ward, New York City, Panama, Peru, and Tuvalu, and others as well.
What are the objects like in the collection? I mean, they're coming from all these different places. Is there a similar theme to them, or does it kind of range the whole gamut?
There's a real variety. They range from a film that came from Ole Jorgen Hammaken, and was produced by Bertrand Lozé, and this is a coming-of-age film set on the west coast of Greenland, which really talks about what does it mean for kids who are growing up in a culture that's being really impacted by climate change, already fraught and may disappear. So there's something like that, a feature-length film. There's also things that look more like garbage. There's a used toothpaste tube from Cuba. There are bricks. There's straw. There are things that have washed up on the shore. There's water from the Lagoon of Venice, and also confetti from the Venice Carnival. From Antarctica, there's a pair of crampons, which you use to hike on the ice. Also from Kivalina, there is a whale vertebra that was carved by Russell Adams Jr., who's a member of the Kivalina community, and that was sent in by Christine Shearer, who was in Kivalina to write a book about Kivalina and its situation. I mean, there are very poignant things, things that look like trash, like a black slipper, that came from the Upper Ninth Ward, but there are also things that would be present in the soil there, such as shells and rocks.
Do you think that, in a sense, the items in this archive are a reflection of those global inequalities that we associate with, or that are associated with global warming and climate change?
I mean, yes, definitely. And I think there are a lot of problems with this project. And I think the question is, how deeply can you look into the project to see these problems? For example, who contributes? You know, my idea about who might contribute is really limited to my social network. People who are living in places that may be disappearing, first of all, may not be able to access this or may not be interested. They're trying to survive, more or less.
Yeah.
Also, too, there's a question about what does an archive say politically? You know, where does the archive go? The archive has things that can move even if people can't. So this problem of preservation of the mobility of things where people can't go. So to speak about inequality, you know, people are fighting, right? You know, in the Pacific Islands, people are fighting climate change. Is this a political moment for them to contribute to an archive? Maybe, maybe not. Do those things have to be exclusive? No, but I think what I'd like to add is that, you know, there's this also a question about audience. An archive presumes a place for things that can be protected. Mm-hmm. So where would an archive exist? And also, who's going to look at this archive in the future? So it presumes an audience. It presumes a place for it. And I'm not sure what that might look like.
The archive is currently, it's stored at a library in San Francisco, but it's going to be traveling soon. If people want to contribute, how do they do so?
So people can contribute in a couple of ways. First of all, the archive is right now at the Prelinger, Library in San Francisco, which is a wonderful, wonderful independent research library that's open to anyone for research and reading and inspiration. And if anyone's in San Francisco, I highly recommend a visit there. It's a wonderful appropriation-friendly resource, and that's why I feel so happy that the archive is there right now. And if people want to contribute, if they're in San Francisco or in the Bay Area, they can drop something by in person any Wednesday through the beginning of April from 1 to 8 p.m., or if you go to sinkingandmelting.org, there's a mailing address for you to send a contribution of less than half a pound, along with information about your contribution, why you wanted to contribute it, where you are, your thoughts upon where you live and why it's disappearing, and just send it, and it will join the archive, and then it will travel with the archive. The next place the archive will go is to Southern Exposure Gallery in San Francisco, and then on to New York in the fall with an exhibition called Lennon Icebreaker.
So if someone were to go to one of these exhibits, what would they actually see?
What they would see is they would see all of the different contributions completely unedited in a timeline by which they were received. And the one thing that they'll see each object on a table, the table's open, and then on the wall is a map showing where they're from and also having information about each object. And most importantly, what I've tried to do is I've added a piece of information about each country's UNFCCC negotiation status. So what it says is not just who contributed from, but basically what the power position is of the country that the contribution came from in terms of climate negotiating power. Because I'm hoping that the collections can talk about also what does it mean to recognize the situation and its politics, but also what is the umbrella of international negotiations that are weighing down very individually upon each contribution.
When I look at a lot of these objects, these little pieces of debris in life, it makes you feel kind of sad. I mean, what is it that you hope that people take away when they view this project?
I hope that people understand that in thinking about what will have been, this is not necessarily what may come, but one possible future. So while this may be an archive of the future, it may just be an archive of the present that points to a future that may not happen if the right action's taken.
Amy Balkin is a San Francisco-based artist. Her projects include The Public Domain, Public Smog, and A People's Archive of Sinking and Melting. For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
And that's Current State for Monday. Join us tomorrow here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day.